Congress is facing a looming deadline for deep cuts to federal spending on March 1st. Critics say if they allow the cuts to proceed, it will throw the nation into fiscal chaos and halt the economic recovery. Supporters of deficit reduction say the cuts don't go far enough, and the federal government must do more to cut down the deficit. What is the right mix? I'm Lori Townsend. Can Congress agree on solutions that avert a crisis? Alaska's Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski joins us to talk about sequestration and a host of other subjects. We'll also take your calls today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, sitting in for vacationing Steve Heimel right now. And hopefully we'll be having Senator Lisa Murkowski in the studio with us very soon. I'm sure she's on her way over here. And we're just waiting. Being a senator, you're busy, things happen, so I'm sure she'll be sliding in here real soon. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Peter Granitz, is also joining us by phone today. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
We will take your calls. You can join us at 1-800-478-8255. That's if you're out of the Anchorage area, 1-800-478-8255 or 1-800-478-TALK. And if you're in the Anchorage area, you can call 550-8422, 550-8422, or you can email us too, talk@alaskapublic.org. All right, Peter, the president spoke today. He was talking about sequestration, the cuts, and he referred to them as, I think he said, using a hatchet. What was he talking
about? I think today was meat cleaver. Today was meat cleaver.
Oh, meat cleaver. That's right. It was meat cleaver.
It's his way of, it's the 2013 version of blunt instrument. We've been talking about the sequester and how devastating it'll be for upwards of a year and a half now. It's these $1.2 trillion of cuts that are supposed to take effect just next week, March 1st, and those cuts will take place over the next decade. Today he was speaking at the White House with a group of, I want to say it was firefighters and police officers around him, public employees, people who are there to protect the public, and they were there to be examples of who might be furloughed, who might lose jobs. And he was saying, we need to get this done, but with this little time and with the Senate out and the House out this week, I don't know that anybody has hope there's going to be a salvo before March 1st.
Well, Peter, in his State of the Union address the other evening, he was talking about a wide range of things. One of them was upgrades to infrastructure around the country. Does this sound like another stimulus package, do you think? Or what have you heard what this might look like?
It does sound like a stimulus package. I remember way back in 2009, the phrase shovel ready, that was a phrase coined to say all these stalled out stimulus or infrastructure projects around the states that the states themselves can't afford, but they're ready to go, the federal government will step in. And that was the stimulus project. Now that's been, it came out to just shy of $800 billion in 2009, and it's been lampooned ever since then, on the left for being too small, on the right for being too big and too ineffective. So the idea of getting any more infrastructure spending, be it for high-speed rail or highway improvements, is probably pretty dim. It's hard to see that happening. And he didn't call for a whole lot. I want to say it was less than $100 billion. Now, I know that sounds like real money to a lot of people, and it is, but it just doesn't seem like it's going to go anywhere. But, yeah, it's stimulus. It's stimulus spending. It's saying let's inject money into the economy to get people working.
And what kind of chances do you think an idea like that has, especially considering what we're looking at right now with this looming sequestration on March 1st? Is an idea like this likely to fly?
It's it, it would be very unlikely, I think. That said, there are groups that usually come behind increased government spending. The Chamber of Commerce was a big champion of the stimulus bill a number of years ago. It was, they represent the business interests. They represent the people who are in the position to hire would-be workers. Labor obviously supports increased government spending because it means that they can get government contracts. But we're entering this area of smaller budgets, and the idea of spending more money on things, worthy though they may be, is just it's not the reality right now. We're looking to cut money, not spend any more.
You're listening to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and on the phone with me is Peter Granitz, APRN's Washington, D.C. correspondent. We're waiting for Senator Lisa Murkowski to join us, hoping that she'll be here shortly. And we'll be talking about federal priorities, the looming deadline for the sequestration. And Peter, there's also another deadline. Wait a minute, I should give those phone numbers for our listeners, because when the senator does get here, I'm sure that people around the state will have questions for. The call-in numbers are 1-800-478-8255. Write these down, so when Senator Murkowski hits the studio, you'll be able to ask your questions. 1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-TALK. Or if you're in the Anchorage area, you can call 550-8422, 550-8422. And you can also email us, talk@APRN.org. So, Peter, we've got the March 1st deadline, the sequester deadline, $85 billion. And then there's a second deadline on March 27th?
That's right. That is when the so-called continuing resolution expires. Now, that's Washington speak for the bill that pays for the government. Everywhere in the world, the year begins January 1st. Or I should say, everywhere in the country, the year begins January 1st, except Washington. The fiscal year actually begins October 1st here, and we're already into the 2013 fiscal year. We were in that in 2012. The Congress passed a bill saying we're going to continue to fund the government at last year's levels until March 27th. That way it'll give the appropriations committees and everybody else in Congress the chance to put together a funding bill to make it all the way through September 30th. That funding mechanism, the continuing resolution, is up March 27th. They need to, the appropriations committees need to figure out what to do until the end of the year. Are they going to stay at the same level and effectively not pass a budget for 2013 and just move on into the 2014 cycle, or are they going to do some kind of appropriations bill to get us through the end of the year? Now, the House Appropriations Chairman, Hal Rogers, a veteran from Kentucky who's been known to insert some of his very own Kentucky pet projects into these huge appropriations bills over his some 20, 30 years in Congress, is starting to work towards a bill to get us through October 1st, or up until October 1st. That would put more permanent footing into the Defense Department and Veterans Affairs Department, but critics are saying it wouldn't do much else for any of the other departments. It's something that I would like to ask Senator Murkowski and any of the other appropriators as to what that stands. But the combination of the two, March 1st and March 27th, that is on purpose. These are not coincidental. Those dates are close on purpose. You can see, or you could envision perhaps, some members saying, well, the sequester is going to happen, and we'll just loop it all together March 27th. We'll pass some kind of funding mechanism that's going to deal with smaller budgets then. And now that puts a lot of uncertainty in the economy up until March 1st, and it creates even more uncertainty between March 1st and March 27th.
It seems that these incremental steps, doing small things to get us just pushed down the road a little bit, don't bode well for trying to get some of these major things that I think it seems as if most people in Congress agree that things have to change as far as the deficit, as far as spending. But the problem is that there's a disconnect of how to get there, how to do that. But these small pushes forward don't seem to bode well for getting this done. What are you hearing from people there?
You're exactly right. I've heard from members of Congress say it's governing by default. Obviously, they're not going to say that in public, but they'll say it, when you're listening in a corner of the Capitol. It's, in some words of people, it's a dereliction of duty, that they're not doing the one thing the Congress is supposed to do, and that's fund the government. The Congress has the power of the purse strings. That's the constitutional function of the Congress. I mean, in addition to other checks and balances, of course, but that's the one that people are most proud of in Congress. But they're not doing it. And these short little stopgap measures, you hear from business leaders, you hear from members of Congress that it's not creating the certainty that the country needs and the economy needs to invest long term. You know, if you're say you're in the defense industry and you want to spend more money on a weapons project or any kind of service for a base, and maybe you need to hire more people, you can't do that if you don't know that the government is going to honor its obligation to you. If you can't do that unless you know for certain you're going to get a contract, and that contract is going to last 12 months, 24 months. And the ironic thing here is that you hear just about every member of Congress, everybody in the delegation has told me, Senator Murkowski, Senator Mark Begich, and Congressman Don Young, that they don't want this to happen, that it's a bad thing, that it's not the way to go about doing it. And you talk to other delegations, you talk to members of Congress from other states, and they say the same thing, but it's just about getting there. And what's an interesting thing, one more interesting thing on this is that, you know, your average, well, if there is such a thing as an average member of Congress, but your rank and file member says they're working at this, but it's all at the leadership level. You know, the rank and file are not, they don't know what's going on. This is, you know, Harry Reid, Mitch McConnell, John Boehner, Nancy Pelosi. Those are the people who are actually doing the work right now, if there is any work being done. And the rank and file are kind of left in the dark. And it's not hard to find a critic say, that's not how the government should function. It should be every member of Congress participating.
I heard an interesting interview with a representative from Minnesota who won his won a seat back after, I think, 20-some years recently. And he was talking about the difference in the way Congress worked in the 70s as opposed to the way that they work now. And the number of hours, the days is much, much less. So it seems like we have kind of a bad combination of things converging here at a time when a lot of work needs to be done. 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK is the number if you're outside of the Anchorage area, 550-8422 in the Anchorage area. We're waiting on Senator Lisa Murkowski to join us. Peter Granitz, our Washington, D.C. correspondent, is on the phone with us, and we're going to take a call, even though the senator isn't here yet. I hope Terry in Valdez doesn't feel ripped off that he doesn't get to ask his question of the senator, but Terry, hi.
Oh, I'm sure she's heard my gripe already. I think what we need to do is stop being the world's police. We have 50,000 troops in Italy. You know, we got to ask ourselves why. You know, I think we have 300,000 troops in Europe, 500,000 total overseas. I mean, that's just a huge drain on our economy because the dollars that go out don't come back to here. At least the bases in the United States, the money recirculates back into our economy. You know, Barney Frank and Ron Paul proposed this last year, and it got no traction at all. But it's just common sense. We're still building bases in Japan. Okinawa has 9 bases, and we're planning on building another. It just doesn't make sense to me.
So, Terry,
a lot of our problems.
What do you think would make sense as far as, do you think that everyone in foreign locations should come back to the United States, or do you think that we need to cut it in half? I mean, do you have an idea of what you'd like to see as far as numbers in these places?
I would say 4/5 anyway. I can see the Navy base in Bahrain and the Persian Gulf, maybe 2 or 3 bases in Japan, but I think we have 40,000 troops in Japan, and there are that many dependents that go with them. You look at how much that drains our economy, and then you look at Korea and all across the world. You can't hardly put enough thumbtacks in the globe to cover all the bases we've got. It's just nuts. And the Navy going all over the world, well, we're a rapid deployment force anymore. We really don't need all these foreign bases. Anyway, I'll get off the phone. Enjoy your show. Thanks.
Thank you, Terry. Thanks for the call. And if you want to call in and talk about your concerns about the looming federal cuts that may hit on March 1st, it will affect just about everything across the board. We're talking about the VA, military spending, the Indian Health Service, infrastructure upgrades. Everything will take a hit if this sequestration does go into effect. And whether or not the senator is here, you can still call in with your concerns, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. Or if you're in Anchorage, call 550-8422. What are your concerns about federal priorities? What do you think the government should cut? What should they keep? Give us a call. Let us know. Peter, we're going to hear now from John, who is in Glen Allen, and he has something to say about the Tanana Bridge. Hi, John.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. I'm concerned. I have a small business here on the Richardson Highway, but nevertheless, for the last couple of months, there's been, a multitude of many, many beams. I've lost count, but supposedly there's going to be a total of approximately 80 bridge beams, 110 foot long, 72 tons each. And they're being trucked up by Carlisle, which is well and good. But the problem I have is that these beams are, and it's been noted, I guess, in the Valdez paper too, professionally made, as usual, in China. Now, that it means the steel, the fabrication, and everything was manufactured, and all the workmanship was made in China, transported probably on Chinese shipping for a federally funded job. Now, the amount of tonnage of steel is about 5,800 tons, a considerable amount of material, and somewhere I'm determined for my price of steel when I buy steel between $3 and $4 million. But that excludes any other type of workers, be it a welder or a fitters or electricians that could be, and steel mill workers that could have been fabricating this steel here, either on the West Coast or in the Pennsylvania area, wherever. There are steel mills out there. I know that for a fact.
So your problem with this, John, is that we're not using enough U.S. labor to get this work done?
No, there's no U.S. labor in the manufacturing of these products, and it's a federally funded job. I thought it was mandated that on federally funded jobs that you had to have American workers and American materials, et cetera, all the way down the line.
Well, that's an excellent question.
All this money goes overseas, to Chinese enterprises.
That's a great question for the senator. When she gets here, we'll ask about what the federal mandate is when it comes to federal funding for jobs, for projects that are getting tax dollars from the federal government.
Right, exactly. This is an part of what I guess they call infrastructure, transportation, quote unquote. That steel could have been brought into Valdez, hired people from around the state. I know there are plenty of welders, fabricators, electricians, millwrights, et cetera, that could have been working on it down there, loading it up, transporting it up the road, or have it done in Fairbanks, for that matter. Bring the steel up there and have it done up in Fairbanks.
John, can I ask?
That's what I'm complaining about.
John, this is Peter in D.C. I'm curious, when you buy steel, if you buy American-made steel for your projects, does it cost more than buying from China?
No, because I usually get my steel out of Anchorage, a Greer tank, or for the specialty type of stainless, which is usually American-made. I get that on the East Coast for boat shafts and things of that nature. But depends. I've been at Greer Tank, and some of the stuff comes in as Pusang, Korean, whatever. And I can tell you, as a machinist and welder, there's a big difference in foreign-made steel and American-made steel. Even Japanese steel is quality, super quality. But, the yen is high, and you don't see that much Japanese steel anymore. But the quality is, I do machine work. It's lousy stuff to weld, nasty stuff to machine because it just doesn't machine properly. But anyway, all the steel that I buy is what I can get at a Greer, unless sometimes you can specifically request a certain type of steel for a specific type of project.
Well, it's an interesting point, and I would say that in past, we talked about the stimulus before, and, there's always been the provision, you have to use Made in America labor and things like that. But at the same time, the president and a number of Republicans and Democrats, virtually, I wouldn't dare say a majority because I don't know the exact number, but, you do see people in Congress saying that the way to get us out of the recession is to increase exports, is to increase international trade. And in the State of the Union, in fact, you heard the president say that, we're working on this Pacific partnership, that there's going to be an increased level of trade between Japan and the U.S. So I can't speak specifically to your projects. I can't tell you that my dad does, in fact, work in a steel mill in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But I can tell you that there will probably be a great conversation about future trade projects in the coming months.
Well, thank you, John, so much for the call. And you raised some really interesting points about where should steel for American projects come from. And I appreciate your call. Thanks so much. We're still waiting for Senator Lisa Murkowski. The word is she will be here momentarily, which is good news. You're listening to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, sitting in for Steve Heimel. The call-in number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling from the Anchorage area, you can call 550-8422, or you can send us an email, talk@aprn.org. Peter Granitz is on the phone with us, our Washington, D.C. correspondent, and I think we'll just take another call until the senator gets to the studio. We have Eleanor in Manicotic, something about a letter to the senator. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi, a little letter to McCarthy concerning the tribal development of tribal courts, because the state court system costs a lot of money. They just built a $1 billion facility there near Lucilla, and they've been using false charges to fill up their justice system, and I believe that the oil revenues are used for that, and they're trying to have more oil drilling, and it's the rate of cancers in our communities is like 31%, and we're forced to use cancer-causing petroleum or diesel for our energy when we could be using renewable energy such as wind turbines. And you know, this cost of providing are paying for all these people that they've imported to work for the justice system and the state systems is just, the earth just can't really support their program.
So, Eleanor, it sounds like you have a few concerns here. Let's start with the tribal court concern. What would you like to see happen in that regard?
Well, back in 1992, the Elders Tribal Council was developed to start a tribal court so they could intervene in children's cases, but it was all compacted out to regionals where they were working and helping the OCS or DFOS, it was called back then, to what BIA called kidnapping, and we wanted to intervene with what the state calls juvenile system so they could mentor with the elders, and mentoring was like teaching them responsibility, going out and doing cutting wood for them, and it, you know, raise their self-esteem. But instead, they were sending them to these juvie halls, and we just had a meeting with the juvie hall justice system, and they said, you know, that their institutions are not helping the rural communities, and they wanted elders to mentor, and you know, the tribal court system has different ways of dealing with their people, and the state system, you have to lie, which is not good. We don't believe in that. Because people tell truth, they get thrown in jail, or they have state troopers come in and write a bunch of trumped-up charges so they could keep them in their court system.
So, Eleanor, it sounds like you would like to see the tribal court system upgraded or enhanced and more use of sort of sentencing circles, perhaps, or mentoring with elders. Senator Murkowski is on the phone with us now. Thank you so much, Eleanor, for that call. And we'll go now to Senator Murkowski. Are you there with us?
I am, Lori, and a huge apology for this scheduling error. This is not acceptable, but we'll have to make up so that I've got a full hour with you in the not-too-distant future. But
well, at least we have you here.
Yeah.
We have you on the phone anyway.
I know, but I wanted to be there in person with you. So.
Yeah, we were hoping to have you in the studio too, Senator, but at least you're here now. And we're going to kind of back into some of the questions now. We're going to be going to a break here in just a few moments. But before we talk about some of the things that Peter and I have been discussing in this first part of the show, I have an email here from someone who wants to know about how sequestration could possibly affect the 8A set-aside programs on a national scale. Do you have any ideas about that, Senator?
Well, we don't have anything in terms of hard numbers or real programs, but what I can tell you is that with sequestration and the cuts to the Department of Defense, you're going to see impact to the jobs. You're going to see impact to the revenues that come to the state because of those jobs. And when it comes to our 8A programs and the contracts that are out there, we have to believe that the Department of Defense will necessarily make reductions in terms of what they are advancing. And keep in mind, it's not just the impact of sequestration. We're also dealing with a continuing resolution in terms of government funding. Right now, the CR takes us through the end of March. And so there is so much that is on hold because we're operating under a continuing resolution, not authorizing new programs. There's a great deal of discussion right now that CR would actually be continued or extended several more months, possibly until the end of the fiscal year. That could also have a debilitating impact on our defense budget and the opportunity for additional programs that our 8A contractors might be able to avail themselves of. So any way you cut it, whether it's sequestration or a continuing resolution extension, I think you're going to see negative impact to our 8As.
You're listening to Talk of Alaska. Today we have Senator Lisa Murkowski on the line with us and also Peter Granitz, our APRN's Washington, D.C. correspondent. You can join our conversation if you have questions for the senator on federal priorities. Certainly there's a lot to ask, and you can call us here at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling in the Anchorage area, it's 550-8422, or you can email us, talk@aprn.org. Before we go to the break, let's get one more email in here, and then we've got some callers on the line that we'll get to after this bottom of the hour break. Here is a question, Senator Murkowski, from someone that is applauding, she says, your efforts at exposing outside donors in campaign financing. She wants to know if you're aware of the growing Move to Amend movement to make clear in the Constitution that corporations are not people. There's apparently a congressman from Minnesota has introduced a We the People amendment resolution in the House. Do you know about this?
Yes, I have. There has been discussion. There's nothing moving on the Senate side that would be a counterpart to that House proposal. I am working with Senator Wyden from Oregon on a proposal that we think will help make a difference as it relates to campaign disclosure and the fact that right now, if you are an individual who wants to write a $15 million check to help elect a candidate, there is a way to do it. You can't write it to the candidate themselves, but we all know that you can go through other entities, these so-called the nonprofit entities, those that form organizations for the specific purpose of election-related activity. We happen to believe that full-on disclosure is good and necessary for everybody. If you write a check for over $500, I think it ought to be disclosed. And Senator Wyden and I are working on just that. We put out a white paper in December based on comments received from that. We are in the process now of drafting legislation, and it's my hope that we'll be able to actually introduce a bipartisan disclosure bill in the Senate that will actually get to the heart of what we're seeing, and that is lack of disclosure when it comes to campaign contributions.
All right. Thank you, Senator Lisa Murkowski, on the line with us, as is Peter Granitz, our Washington, D.C. correspondent. We're going to be taking some calls when we come back after this break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
The Kinnickarm Crossing would connect Anchorage to the Mat-Su Valley. The bridge is intended to create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and save freight costs for Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnickarm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Senator Lisa Murkowski is on the phone with us today, as is Peter Granitz, our Washington, D.C. correspondent. Senator, Peter and I were talking earlier about the sequester and the fact that this big deadline on March 1st, $85 billion in cuts, the president says it's going to throw the economy into chaos, people will lose jobs. Do you see this as inevitable?
Well, I wish that I could say that I think that we will be able to pull this back and put in its place something that is more reasoned, more thoughtful, and less painful to individuals and their families. But I'll tell you, the signals that I'm getting are not good. I had a meeting just last week with the president's nominee to be Secretary of the Treasury, and when I asked him how he saw sequestration playing out, he indicated that he believed it was not a question of if sequestration goes into place, but how long it will be in place. Now, that doesn't give me much comfort. I don't think it gives others much comfort as well. I pressed for a hearing in the Appropriations Committee to see if we couldn't hear directly from cabinet members how they feel the cuts will impact their departments. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Napolitano, I was pretty detailed in some of the things that she felt were going to be coming our way. She mentioned such things as cuts within FAA that could delay flights, cuts within TSA that could delay your time within airports in terms of moving through. From a Coast Guard perspective, she said that it would impact our Coast Guard and their efforts by a considerable amount, and she specifically singled out their Arctic operations. I've asked the question about what might happen within IHS. We've got a trust responsibility to our Native peoples, Alaska Natives and American Indians, and how those cuts might impact us. I wish that I could tell you, Lori, that we weren't going to be seeing this sequester go into place, but right now, it's not looking very good. There's a couple different proposals that are out there. The Democrats on Thursday, just before we left, laid out a proposal that's basically equal revenue increases to equal cuts. There's an awful lot of folks that are saying, look, we just increased revenues, we just increased taxes on the 31st of December. It's a month later. We don't think it's time to be doing that. Bull Simpson just released another plan this morning. I'm looking at that to see if that might be a path forward. There's a lot of different efforts out there. We haven't really seen the plan from the president in terms of what he might propose. And we're sitting here just less than 2 weeks away from a meat cleaver approach to cutting the budget. And it's tough right now.
Well,
Senator Murkowski, I'm curious. Alaska is second in the country in terms of percentage of government workers. I mean, second to D.C. Some Gallup numbers here, the most recent ones, show that 28% of the state works for government in some form. That could be local or federal. But can we expect that those 28% of people are going to see furloughs starting next week?
No, I don't think it's fair to say that. In fact, I think it would be raising false alarms. You're correct in terms of the size of our active federal civilian employees. We've got about 13,000 active, about 24,000 uniformed military personnel. We rank third in the U.S. in percentage of federal employees here in this state. We rank second in federal defense spending as a percent of our state's GDP. So the point here is we're going to be impacted mightily because of our demographics here, because of those who live here. The Air Force is looking to furlough up to 180,000 Air Force civilians for 22 days. Now, this is Air Force-wise. In Alaska, we're looking at a total of 2,407 civilians could face lost wages due to furloughs. The impact on the Alaskan economy is over $18 million. The Army looking to furlough approximately 2,200 civilians. They could also lose about 20% of their pay. So just kind of think about what that might mean. Now, it's important to recognize that that doesn't mean come March 1, anybody who is a federal employee, whether you're a civilian within Department of Defense or whether you work for the National Park Service, you should not expect that you're going to see a furlough. This is what we were trying to get to last Thursday, was how are you going to handle this? Whether you're the Department of Defense or whether you're the Department of the Interior, how are you going to handle these cuts that are coming your way? Some are looking at furloughs. Others are looking at other ways to reduce spending, whether it's cuts to programs. But the assumption should not be made that if you are a federal employee that you're going to be seeing an automatic furlough or an automatic reduction in your pay.
Senator Murkowski, I want to get to the phones here in just a moment and let some of our callers ask some questions as well. You're listening to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. We have Senator Lisa Murkowski on the line with us and APRN's D.C. correspondent Peter Granitz. But along those lines with the a couple questions first on the sequester before we go to the phones. First, you said something interesting about it depends on how long the sequester is in place. Are we talking about perhaps this March 1st deadline hits, we have to dip our toes in the waters of having them cut off in some respect and then can pull back the rest of the foot? Or what are you talking about here when how long the sequester is in place?
Well, it's a real issue that we're dealing with right now. There is a lot of discussion about, well, okay, so the 1st of March comes and goes, and we're going to have departments looking at how they make these 5.1% cuts, 7.2% cuts, whatever, wherever those cuts are going to be. But it takes a while to put these into place. And if, let's just say, by April 1, there is a proposal within the Congress that realigns, essentially, this sequestration that gets us to meeting the parameters set out in the Budget Control Act from last year, a way to soften the blow, if you will, or reprioritize, that is something that the Congress can do. I think if there is any agreement out there between the executive and the legislative branch, Republicans and Democrats, it's that nobody anticipated that this sequestration hammer was actually ever going to fall. We put it in place in the Budget Control Act to basically keep us honest in terms of making sure that we move forward with the reductions in spending that had been outlined. But everyone agreed that these across-the-board cuts were not the wise and sensible approach to reductions in spending. And so all along, everyone has said, the president said when he was campaigning last year and said it as he says it every, you know, whenever he speaks about it, everyone agrees that this is not the methodology to use, but this is what we have in front of us as we speak. So if we can work to reprioritize of what we've done with this sequestration, I think that's the goal. And how long will that take? That's anybody's guess. I would like to think that we don't have to dip our toe in the water and get them sliced off.
And Senator Murkowski, you mentioned talking to military leaders and others about how are you going to prepare for these. A few weeks back, there was what was called a mock RIF exercise on the Army side of the Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Mock RIF was explained to me as a mock reduction in force, where people got letters saying, you know, if this had been an actual cut, here's the steps that you would have to take. And people were encouraged to sign up for certain types of services just to be prepared. Are you hearing of these kinds of moves on bases? And how does this affect military personnel's morale?
Well, first of all, I think it is it's a lousy way to deal with what we have in front of us. Whether we're talking about 22 furloughed days over the course of the year or a mock RIF, at the end of the day, you are having an impact on individuals and their families. We can't be messing with people's lives in an attempt to politicize an issue so that we can gain some kind of advantage. And I'll be very, very direct and upfront. There are some who say, by gosh, we need to make such drastic cuts that we get the attention of everybody so that they recognize that, nope, you can't cut defense spending, or no, you can't cut on the discretionary side. We should be working to avoid the most painful of the cuts, to soften the impacts to people and their families. And when we had this hearing last week, the representative from OMB specifically said, no, the administration was not planning to make the cuts less painful. I think that's what we need to be working on here, folks. We need to be working on how we reduce our spending. But let's not use, whether there are civilian employees who work for Department of Defense, or whether they're folks that are working for the Forest Service here, let's not use them to make a point here. This is too critical. Now, I want to speak just a little bit more about your point about this mock RIF. One of the things that is going on within the department that does concern me, last week we learned that the Army, Navy, and the Marines have all been allowed to exceed their funding levels that are in place now by the continuing resolution. And as a consequence of this, all three of the services are going to face shortfalls if Congress continues the continuing resolution for the balance of the year, and we have every indication at this point in time that looks like it might be the case. So what we're essentially dealing with is that the department is not paying attention to the continuing resolution, much less the sequestration and what may happen there. So I'm anxious about the lack of understanding in terms of where the departments would go on March 1 if we are unable to resolve this prior to that time. And I think it needs to be measures that folks can live with, not measures that are going to impact the morale, really frighten families. This is not how we ought to be operating.
You're listening to Talk of Alaska. Senator Lisa Murkowski is our guest today, and we are talking about federal priorities. We're going to go back to the phones for a moment and hear from Harry in Golovin, who has a question or a comment about the F-16 transfer. Harry, are you there?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Lisa Murkowski. In opposition of moving F-16 from Fairbanks to Anchorage, for the simple fact that the proximity of Fort Greely, which has a missile base, and the Alaska Pipeline. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I know the first attack would be our infrastructure, such as our pipeline, our missile defense system, and if they move F-16 from Fairbanks to Anchorage, that will further their missions. They'll be farther away from the pipeline. They'll be farther away from National Petroleum Reserve which is in North Slope, and without F-16 protection, it's very vulnerable to attack. And I very oppose this transfer of our F-16.
Well, thanks, Harry, for that comment. Senator, what is the prospect there? It's kind of hanging in the air at this point, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I really appreciate Harry's comments coming out of Golovin. This is an issue that I think impacts all of us. This is not just an interior Alaska issue. This is about the security, our national security here, Alaska's ability to really provide for a level of readiness for the entire nation. And Eielson has a hugely important role, and those F-16s are critical to that mission, particularly as we look to the Asia-Pacific. What is important to keep in mind, there was a series of scoping hearings held in South Central and up in the interior within the past couple weeks. It is so important that Alaskans weigh in. We had great turnout up in the interior. Over 800 people participated, overwhelmingly speaking in opposition to the move. And down here in South Central, while the turnout was not as impressive as it was up north, again, a repeated insistence that it is better for our preparedness, it is better for our communities that the F-16s remain at Eielson. It is not too late to weigh in. We have opened up a website on my website, lisamurkowski.senate.gov, to submit your comments prior to the 1st of March. It's important that the Air Force hear from Alaskans all over the state. So, Harry, I would hope that if you haven't submitted your comments, that you would please do so, because this is, again, key to so many different reasons in terms of our national security and the security of the assets that we've had in place for some time up in the interior.
1-800-478-8255 is the number to call if you're out of the Anchorage area. We have Senator Lisa Murkowski on the phone with us. 550-8422 is the local number. We had a call earlier, Senator, before you were able to join us, about federally funded projects using foreign steel, bridge projects in Alaska. Are there mandates for, if there's federal funding involved, that you have to use U.S. products and U.S. workers, or is it just a priority and people have to try to do those things? How is that? How does that work?
Well, when we had the ERA funds that were advanced as part of a stimulus several years back, there was a Buy America provision. And many Alaskans might recall that this issue came up in consideration of the steel that was to be used in the bridge out over the Tanana River there. And it was important, I think, to recognize that while we want to ensure that we have U.S. jobs manufacturing the steel, federal funds being used for this, let's encourage that to the fullest extent possible. We also recognize that in certain instances, it may add considerably to the cost, and so there is a I don't know if it's a waiver provision or flexibility built into that law that allows for basically a look back if in fact it adds unduly, and I apologize, I can't recall exactly what the percentage of increase to the cost. But I think it is important, again, as we look to making sure that we're not outsourcing our jobs, that we're not sending our manufacturing overseas, that we send a strong message here within this country about Buy America.
Thank you, Senator Murkowski. We are talking with Senator Lisa Murkowski today on Talk of Alaska, and we're going to take a short break. Then we have a lot more questions and callers on the line as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. We have Senator Lisa Murkowski on the phone with us, and we're going to go back to the phones now. We have Jennifer in Seward, who wants to talk, Senator Murkowski, about gridlock in Congress. Jennifer, are you there?
Yeah, hi. Yeah, my concern is, you know, the sequestration is only the recent thing that's coming about. It seems like month by month, ever since President Obama was elected the first time, whatever he wants to do, it's the Republicans want to do opposite. And no matter where it comes from, if he supports it, all of a sudden they say no. And I don't understand why the Congress's job is to legislate, to make bills, to pass the legislation the president can veto or not, and yet they can't seem to get the work done. All they're interested in is stopping the president. And we're at such a crucial point in our country right now, why can't the love of country and helping the country take precedence over their hatred for Obama? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Well, Jennifer asks a really good question. I think the observation from so many outside of the nation's capital is that this gridlock is impassable, and it's not just Republicans versus Democrats. It's really Republicans versus the president. That may appear to be the case, certainly from the outside. Let me just tell you where I'm coming from. And Jennifer, you need to know that to a great extent, I share your frustration. I disagree with the president on certain of his policies. I disagree with the president with some of the nominees that he has sent forward. But the bottom line is he is duly elected as our president and will be in that position for 4 years. Now, my job is to make sure that Alaska's views are represented in the Congress, and that means if I need to take the president on an issue, I will do that. But I also recognize that we have an obligation to deal with one another in a manner that is respectful. You can still disagree on issues, but you don't have to be coarse or disrespectful, or you don't need to take it personally. I have I've kind of gone out on point once again in making sure that the president's prerogative as the commander-in-chief to select his cabinet is respected. And case in point is Senator Hagel, whose name has gone forward as secretary of the Department of Defense. I have not fully concluded where I may be on an up or down vote for Senator Hagel. Right now, my inclination is to oppose him because I don't think that he has been clear and really unequivocal on issues as they relate to Iran, to situations in the Middle East, and how do we deal with terrorist organizations. But whether or not I support or oppose the president's nominee, I believe very strongly that the president and his nominee deserve to have a vote in the Congress. And so I don't think that we should filibuster the nominee. I don't think that we should delay that vote. Now, I understand that there was a legitimate request by some to get information. I believe they got the information that they were seeking. And so to continue to delay a vote, in my mind, it does not observe our own process as we have established, as is established, quite honestly, in our Constitution. So there are ways that we can voice our disagreements on issues. But it does not help the country. It does not allow us to govern as we need to govern when we resort to personal ad hominem attacks that don't get us anywhere.
Senator, I just want to jump in here quick. We only have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to get to another question off this very serious and, of course, worthy of conversation deficit situation with the country. But the drill rig Kulik, Shell's drill rig, as you know, broke free, went aground in bad weather. Now the vessel is heading for repairs. Does what happened to that vessel impact your perspective on the possibilities for offshore drilling? How do you see, on balance, what happened here in the larger scale of offshore Arctic exploration and drilling?
Well, I think it is important to note that when it came to the drilling, the exploration drilling operations up north this summer, it didn't make the news. There was no incident. There was no accident. It was not newsworthy in that sense, and that's a good thing. But I will tell you, I share the concerns that so many others do, that it's not just about the drilling operation itself. It's the whole initiative. You got to move the assets up north and then back. All aspects of the operation need to be tended to. Now, I understand that this was a marine incident. Marine incidents happen, but I do think, I share the concerns of many, that that all areas were not fully attended to, and a level of assuredness to us as Alaskans, to us as Americans, and quite honestly. And it's important that we have high standards and that those high standards are met. I think we're going to see the review coming out very shortly here from Department of Interior. We'll see where that takes us. Of course, the Coast Guard has a much more thorough and comprehensive review that we will be waiting for. We will have hearings in the Congress. We'll hopefully have an opportunity within the Energy Committee as well to look at the drilling operations up north last summer. It's important that we all understand, have an opportunity to ask the questions and gain that assurance.
And, Senator, we only have about a minute left, but in that remaining minute, do you think that it's possible that the redundancies that will be needed, the flotilla of vessels that need to come up with the potential for drilling offshore, will it price producers out of the Arctic because of the need to bring everything with them?
It's certainly a consideration. I think you look to what Shell put together, their commitment. It didn't detract them. And I think, again, the expectation of high standards and the ability to perform the job safely will continue to be there. Cost is an issue, but if you can't provide for what is needed, then that's a significant factor in terms of what we do up there.
Thank you, Senator Lisa Murkowski, for joining us today. Also, Peter Granitz.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.